This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Did you guys record today?
No, but we're all together, so we're talking about it. Teddy doesn't know that yet.
I might got things I got to do instead better for me. I like doing better than this.
Anywho.
Well, our podcast. Yeah. I like doing this more than our podcast.
Okay.
Bobby's a control freak.
He just likes Universal movies.
Oh, yeah. I don't like Universal. I like the Congos, and I like the huge Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah. Universal did. That was Steven Spielberg did Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with his Ramblin' production company.
Universal has the rights to all dinosaur movies because they got that logo at the beginning.
They own dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, from listening to you guys, the pop culture references in your show are just incredible. Lots of movies or TV shows that I just don't really think about that often, but...
Well, you know what? I appreciate that, and I think you're in like the perfect generation for it too, because I looked at your Twitter earlier, and you had reposted a picture of Surge Cola, which I was like, oh yeah, it's perfect. That's all the pop references being hidden with Chris. So.
Oh yeah, he gets it. He watched The Simpsons.
Surge Cola was disgusting.
Is Surge Cola from Simpsons or Futuramas?
I thought it was just a drink they put out. Was it a reference?
Oh, wait, it was a drink.
It was a drink.
All right, I'm thinking of, okay. I'm thinking
it would have been better if it was in partnership or something.
Oh, I want Surge.
Anywho, but yeah.
Yeah, we do have lots of references. I didn't necessarily know how to learn how to read until I was in my age, I don't know. And so I like to watch things and people tell me things and I just remember it. I like cling to it, like Charlie Bucket holding on to a golden ticket. Like someone tells me a fun fact about, ant abdomens or something about, bugs pooping or anything bug related. And I just grab the idea in my mind. I run with it.
Just bug stuff.
I mean, mostly bug stuff. That's how it started. I start small and then I get big. Go from, a blade of glass to a Universal Studios title card.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow. You gotta do small things before you do big things.
I don't remember what the question
Chris would
was,
agree.
But I think
the
that maybe
we're talking about our references. And I mean, we just, I learned from it because I'm illiterate. Bobby learned from these things because he's observant and kind of autistic. And he's about, he's around 5'8.
Why do you say that? I'm way taller than 5'8, for the record. Yeah.
But, so he's closer to things like cereal box logos and magazine covers at the grocery store. So there's just a lot that's a perfect combination. And I mean, we first fell in love with each other in a friendly platonic way over our love for Home Improvement, of course. But you love Home Improvement too. Do you like Home Improvement, Chris?
I do, because Tim Allen being from Michigan, and I'm from Michigan as well. So
you're from Michigan, like Tim Allen.
That's crazy. That's actually we met.
That's where we met. We met in Michigan at the airport. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, it was about, what was it, maybe 12, 15?
Yeah, about 15 years ago.
About 15 years ago, and we were there at the airport.
We were going to a home improvement convention.
Yeah.
That's really it.
I mean, it was a home improvement convention. It was kind of a deception. It was kind of, I feel like I got scammed. We thought there'd be, Patricia Richardson's and different people from the show.
We don't have to talk about it.
Well, I mean, he brought it up.
Well, but
he's from Michigan.
It wasn't a home improvement convention. It was like a home improvement
convention. It was like Home Improvement, like the Home Improvement. Tips. It was Home Improvement, like Home Improvement.
Yeah,
gardening shears and
but there was
refuse
somebody
bags.
Else out there that also thought that it was something else. So, yeah. But yeah, it's an embarrassing story.
Yeah, we were crying.
We don't need to talk about it.
No, we talked enough about it, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Michigan, that's crazy. So you live in Michigan right now?
You still in Michigan?
Yes.
Huh?
Yep. Yep, yep. Oh, I'm like
close to Burke Ramsey.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't realize after digging into this case more, the ties between the Ramseys and Michigan. That's crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you hear our North Fox Island episode was talking about the aviations in Michigan with John Ramsey's dad?
Oh, I don't think I've listened to that one yet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, episode 25, like episode 26.
He was like the director of the Aeronautics Commission in Michigan from like the 50s until the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically doubled the amount of airspace, like the airports. And he ended up being like the guy that helped create the FAA.
Uh-huh.
And getting them in charge of.
Which they've been doing a great job lately.
Yeah. And he was like this director of a commission that basically made all the rules for airports.
For planes, mm-hmm. for runways, for who could have a runway, including pedophiles.
It's crazy.
Yeah. We did a 2-episode special. It's a blockbuster episode.
Check
series.
It out. I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, though. I'm sorry for your thing.
Yeah, go ahead and ask us more questions, Corey.
No, you guys are good. I actually, maybe this is a good point where I'll give you guys a proper introduction really quick for everybody out there listening. Hi, my name is Chris. This is Chitesh, and today I'm joined by two very special guests, Bobby and Teddy of the JonBenet Today podcast YouTube channel. How are you guys?
Oh, we're so great.
Thank you so much. That was intro. We were fantastic. We are doing great. We're doing wonderful. We've been investigating this case for over a year now.
And we're also on Apple Podcasts, so really wherever you get your podcast.
Uh-huh, yeah.
YouTube is a smaller...
If you're part of the burgeoning kind of group of podcast addicts out there that you just need constant audio stimulation in your ears, we are really good podcasts to listen to, and we're really grateful for people joining our journey and our investigation.
And Chris, for those kind words that he just gave us.
Well, yeah, Chris. I mean, you know, he's great. I mean, he's fantastic so far. I don't know nothing about him.
Well, he's got us on here. So.
Well, I mean, I don't know like anything in terms of like his deepest, darkest secrets.
Oh, that's true. We'll get there, though, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Just for the audiences, your podcast YouTube channel, specifically, if you guys were to give like the short summary, if somebody asked you what it was about, it's about JonBenet Ramsey.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. JonBenet Ramsey, precious little angel.
All the untimely dead characters that surround the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been going like piece by piece, looking at each person, making each episode about one specific thing. And that's really helped us see like, you know, the bigger picture.
Yeah, it's one of the most salacious, unsolved murder mystery, pop culture, cornerstone events of American histories. And there's so much more to it than what typically be just summarized in just a couple minutes, which is often how it's spoon-fed when it's been, summarized or touched on in mainstream media and other sort of avenues where, you know, it's always a news segment, but then it's about, okay, well, you know, there's implicit and explicit biases that appear in so many different media pieces about this that you can look at so many of the artifacts and go, what did they include? What did they not include? How did they describe it? Who are they interviewing? Who are they excluding? At what point in the timeline of this 30 years nearly of this whole phenomenon of this unsolved little girl's death, found dead in the basement of her family's home the day after Christmas in Boulder, Colorado in 1996. The fact that it's still a mystery, there's a lot of different kind of contexts that really we've discovered in our dogged pursuit of truth and justice and finding mm-hmm. the perpetrators and the truth behind it all, that it really requires an unpeeling of so many onion layers. And it takes, I mean, we just released our 50th episode, and our episodes are about, what do you think, Mom? I mean, between like 40 minutes to 120 minutes, or an hour and 20 minutes. And
Yeah.
So sometimes, I mean, every installment is pretty hearty, and each installment isn't too redundant over anything else we've discussed in the past, because there's still so much to talk about. And we have found that it's been really edifying and instructive, and also, I think essential for us to have this kind of long form investigative format of a podcast with our personalities, with our approaches, with Bobby's amazing research abilities and my incredible analyzing.
Long-winded monologue.
Yeah, long-winded monologues. I'm good at it, but people listen. And so we're proud that we've been doing it for so long.
You had mentioned that year, 1996, and I wanted to get your guys' take on that time period. This is like a time period where I'm a kid, like I'm growing up, I'm very young, but I don't really realize that there's a lot of stuff going on at this time. And you talk about murders or mysteries or investigations. You have other things going on, such as O.J. Simpson, Ron Goldman, mm-hmm. Nicole Simpson. You have Selena, Oklahoma City, Waco, I mean, Tupac, Biggie, Columbine bit later. Even obscure ones, maybe like Phil Hartman getting murdered by his wife.
Right. And, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Right.
We've been working on a series that we're going to do adjacent to JonBenét today.
This is exclusive, Chris. We haven't talked about it with no one. Yeah.
And it's going to be JonBenét Today presents True Hollywood Myths.
Mm-hmm.
And so each episode is going to focus on some sort of famous Hollywood crime.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of things. And this was a period of time, 1996, when a lot of the varnish and the veneer of just, you know, the sort of the things that were propagated by Hollywood or magazine or like celebrity culture, especially coming from the 80s. A lot of that stuff, the varnish was starting to wear off and people were starting to see underneath the surface and oftentimes in these like, you know, strange, violent, you know, things like OJ or what have you. And also it's important to remember, Chris, since she was just a little fetus at the times, that this was also around the time the World Wide Web began. Yes. And that changed how people get their information, communicate with each other in the biggest way since the Gutenberg Bible was first published, which was when I was a fetish.
One other thing to add to that, something that goes unnoticed, the Olympic bombing in Atlanta. And I think that happened in 1996 as well, I think.
And Lynn Wood, his connection with that, because he ended up representing Richard Jewell.
The
security guard. That was how he started his whole rise to fame, where he was the defender of the damned.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the Ramses took him on even more, because it was like, oh, this guy's just now getting his britches, you know, mm-hmm. with this high profile case.
Yeah.
It's crazy, the web of connection to different things. But yeah, Richard Jewell. Have you seen that movie? That's a good movie.
It's a good movie. John Hamm does not show his penis, though.
No, why would he need to?
Well, sometimes he does.
Okay.
His last name's Hamm, Bobby.
Okay.
It's a big penis. Chris, have you seen John Hamm's penis?
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to disrupt on my...
Hopefully you can edit that for you.
Yeah, he can edit it.
I've seen Mad Men, but I don't remember John Hamm showing anything in Mad Men.
No, he didn't show his penis.
He wouldn't do it in Mad Men. Come on, Chris.
Mad Men's great.
It's okay.
Shut up,
Mad Men. It would be better if he showed his penis. I mean, comment in the comment section below.
No.
Would you prefer Mad Men if it had a little bit of John Hamm peen every maybe like, I don't know, every three episodes?
Why?
Just a little reminder.
This is cable television. Anyhow, I'm sorry, Chris.
You know, all those events that we just mentioned, and you have this little girl, JonBenét Ramsey, who gets murdered. What do you think is the thing that separates this case, JonBenét Ramsey, from all those other cases that we mentioned?
Well, I mean, it's one of the biggest murder investigations in the history of murder investigations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, it's bigger than the RFK assassination.
Yeah,
it's got more Martin Luther King's assassination.
More of a paper trail. More things that have been done for this case in particular than even Martin Luther King.
And again, that it's unsolved. Uh-huh. And really, just how much it's split people. Because again, for people that don't know, part of your audience maybe not know, on Reddit, there's two different subreddits for people that very much believe an intruder did it and that people that think the parents are involved somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And the story not only of this, like, this American family that seems to have it all, and there was such a you know, just a lionizing and idolatry of folks who you know, managed to do well in the American system. You know, people like the Ramseys who are able to become CEOs and have their white picket fence and their perfect house and, you know, had kept up a facade of just like, oh, they really got it figured out. And other people look to them. They were pillars of the community. And I mean, we watched, and when we were watching TV, we're watching things like Family Matters and Full House, things on TGIF on Fridays, and Sabrina the Teenage Witch, where, I mean, we weren't watching things that were like Shameless, Shameless, or something that showed the American, or not even Malcolm in the Middle hadn't come out yet, which even that came at a time when we needed something that was even a little bit more truthier to how people were really living.
Married with Children.
Well, Married with Children. But like the thing with the Ramseys is like, it, like, you know, to have your daughter show up dead, you know, in the family home on the holiday season, and she's, you know, she's got central casting sort of she's you know, like physically, like, you know, like what's the word I'm looking for, like attractive, and not in a sexual sense, but in a sense of like she was a beauty pageant star. She, you know, she was you know, destined to be on magazines and, you know, go see Taylor Swift concerts.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And switch out, you know, wristbands and things. But then instead on, you know, on Christmas night, like, you know, going into the morning after, she instead is found in the darkest room, you know, bundled up in a blanket on the floor.
After a ransom note is found. That's the other thing about this case is where it's like the only case where this has ever been the circumstances.
Yeah.
Where a body is found in the same place where they were supposedly kidnapped from. There's a ransom note.
Mm-hmm. And this is at a time when the statistics in Boulder were that there had been no murders in the city for the entire year. And then days before the new year, a six-year-old girl is found dead in her family's home with apparently it was part of a botched kidnapping plot. But the reason why this separates itself from so many other things is that this came at a time where we were looking at a real engagement from not just the people who are receiving the news, the folks, you know, sitting and watching the news and hearing about this story, but them actually talking about it amongst themselves, and also them following the breadcrumbs as they went along, and then also us discovering how different actors in this whole investigation, in this whole story, including the Ramsey parents, how they also were playing that field as well.
I wanted to kind of ask you guys specific things about the case, because there's things that, just listening to you guys, that I'm for the first time hearing that are, you know, brand new to me. And just to kind of set the scene, what was happening like immediately before JonBenet was murdered? Like, what was the household like on maybe, let's say, like the night before? Because you were saying this kind of happened at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bobby, I mean, you've done so much research. This is a great question for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, is like, it seems like the circumstances of what happened that night before she was found are kind of murky. Mm-hmm. The family's given two different descriptions on when they arrived home from they supposedly went out for a Christmas party. This is Christmas Day. Okay. So they wake up, they do presents. Mm-hmm. John supposedly goes and loads the plane for their trip the next day. The kids are playing with their new toys, Burke's got a Nintendo 64.
Because they have a private jet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a private jet, it's a prop plane. But he has a private plane. He has his own private plane. So they get back, you know, and they're like, oh, we got to go to our friends, the Whites, for a Christmas party that they're having over there. Mm. They go over there, and basically at some point they leave, They stop at a few friends' house to drop off gifts along the way. At some point, they now say JonBenet falls asleep in the car. They carry her upstairs, put her to bed. And then Burke wants to play with her, put together some toy. John helps him put together some toy. Mm-hmm. And then Burke goes to bed, and mm-hmm. John joins Patsy in bed.
That's their story.
That's their story, which they originally, in the original statements, Burke says he saw JonBenet walk up the stairs, so she wasn't mm-hmm. asleep.
And then later on, in 2015's, around then, Burke was on Dr. Phil, and he changed the official narrative, saying that
getting up,
he actually went downstairs while they were all asleep, which has never been part of his parents' line.
Right, and or a part of, yeah, the actual official narrative. Mm-hmm. But they also, again, have an account of them reading to JonBenet and Burke before, you know, bed kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So those, it's switched on what exactly happened the night before. And then supposedly they get up 5:30 Christmas morning. Patsy finds a daughter or finds the note on the stairs.
Three pages.
She doesn't really read staircase. The whole thing, supposedly. And then, you know, asks John, what do we do? Mm-hmm. John says, call the police. She says, are you sure? He says, yes. Supposedly, this is their account. And then the rest is pretty much on record for when they call the police, mm-hmm. like 5:52.
Yeah, around there. Mm-hmm. Police quickly arrive, but so do the Ramsey friends because they were called to come over later.
Right, immediately after the yeah. police, they call over a bunch of their friends.
And it's like this whole, and then it just turns into a confederacy of dunces where you've got police officers there who are being given instructions to like treat the Ramseys like, you know, like they're victims. And, you know, you've got friends of the Ramseys there who are wiping down counters with paper towels and Windex and shit.
And victims advocates.
And victim advocates. And you got, and you got all this, a whole bunch of shenanigans going on that then, you know, when you really start to pierce through the veil of, you know, ground zero, which I'm not talking about 9/11, which happened September 11th, 2001. But ground zero in the sense of like this day of this. And then if you start to segment it out into what happened in the next 3 months after that, what about the 6 months? What about 1 year? What about 3 years? What about 25 years, which is where we're near, you know, where we're at. And then some where there's just, there's so many, it's like, it's almost like when you're crocheting, there's just so many threads to loop around in things. And, you know, we had a quote in one of our episodes where we talked about how there's just so many different timelines and us getting to indulge and get to like look at, okay, what about these employees or coworkers of John's? Okay, what about Patsy's parents? You know, doing different episodes on different participants, we get to spend time on even one, learning the chronology of what they're doing and what happened, but then also more about the relationships with people, and then also just able to pose more questions that sometimes buttress and or, you know, kind of create like an interesting alchemy with other questions we've had, mm-hmm. where we really determined we want to solve this murder. And it really seems like because of how complex this case is, you really have to do it in this format that takes as long form.
One of the things that you guys had talked about, I remember on an episode, was about the 911 call, like that initial call that Patsy makes, that she's calling about, hey, her daughter's missing. And there was something interesting that you had talked about with the 911 call, that perhaps that there was something extra that was said, that the 911 operator didn't hang up and kind of caught some audio that is very, very hard to hear. Can you guys talk about that?
Yeah. Kim Archuleta, who was the 911 operator, I believe she even testified before the grand jury in regards to what she heard after what she thinks they hung up the phone, which we did an episode recently that went in depth on a Reddit post that somebody had made that showed what type of phone they had. And it was one that very much, if you thought you hung it up, like it was on speakerphone, that it would just transfer over to speakerphone. Like if you were talking on it and you hung it up, it was very easy to do on there.
People used to have phones in their homes, Chris.
And that's the thing. If they had it, their doorbell would actually activate their phone in their home as well.
Oh, wow.
But so it was a very elaborate phone system, but this Kim Archuleta, when Patsy, it seems like she gets away from the phone where she's like, hurry, please. And then she stays on. She's like, Patsy. They had it by like two different institutes analyzed this audio afterwards. And they determined that you could hear a boy's voice on the tape saying, what did you find? And then you hear John say, we're not talking to you. And this is while you hear Patsy freaking out in the background as well, going, help me, Jesus,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Jesus is a character in a religion called Christianity that was invented in Colorado.
The Ramseys have also said that, like, you know, Burke was not downstairs during that incident. Mm-hmm. He never came down out of his room. because they, again, they wanted to maintain no matter what. He never left his room all night from when they put him to bed. Mm-hmm. And so they've denied that he was ever there.
They also maintain that they never asked him questions about that night either.
Right, which I think is like a lie.
Come on.
Yeah, and Burke was questioned before the grand jury, too, where supposedly he was shown the 911 tape, and he did admit that it did sound like his voice. I personally, when I listen to it, I don't hear that much with it, and I don't put that much stock into it. I think it is weird that there is a reason they're lying about it, and the fact that like Burke would admit that he heard his voice, that's important.
Because
again, I think it was a, you know, the initial thing of trying to shield him.
And I also think that there might be something to David Archuleta's, I mean, sorry, Kim Archuleta, the quality of the call when she first took it versus any copy that we have, or even just a higher quality copy that maybe isn't necessarily what, you know, we necessarily have either. Of like, you know, imagine you're a 911 operator in Santa Barbara, Colorado, a city that didn't have no murders the entire year of 1996. And then you're working the shift after Christmas Day where it's probably normally dead quiet. It's like someone going like, oh, I need change for my tires because I'm in the snow because I drive out here. Because blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And instead you're getting some lady saying that her daughter's been kidnapped. But also the way that Patsy goes about it, there's certain ways in which, you know, it's almost like when someone killed somebody and they say, but they're trying to pretend they're innocent, and they say, oh, I loved him, or I was, they start talking in past tense. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's almost like Patsy Ramsey was doing things that were like kind of almost in a way designed to like play a narrative of her being a distraught mother discovering a ransom letter. Without, but also you can kind of almost tell like she already knows JonBenet is dead, even though they don't discover JonBenet's body for another 6 hours.
A lot of people point to, they think that she starts at it with like, we need an ambulance, where she almost starts the whole call with, we need a, I don't know, it's like she's saying, it's like police, like it's a whole.
Yeah, when your daughter's missing, not dead, allegedly.
And she was a performer, you know, by nature.
Patsy Ramsey's, yeah. She was a Miss America candidate. She was the smartest person they could muster to stand straight and not.
But her talent was basically a dramatic reenactment from her favorite play, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie,
which is about a letter being penned by two authors that is trying to, it's like the whole major plot point that, you know, then it's about, you know, the fact that there's a ransom letter in here at this on the same, you know, in this circumstance. It's like interesting because it's like, I don't know, there's a lot of things that are parallels.
Does Patsy call the police right away when she first discovers the letter, or does it take time for her to call?
Supposedly, she had the letter, she screamed for John, and, well, she went and checked JonBenet's room. That's changed as well as, like, whether or not she checked Burke's, too.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's some sort of exchange, supposedly, between her and John.
And she would also say that she was, like, doing some packing and stuff. So, like, before she even went downstairs. Like, she's almost like, what? She probably woke up around, like, 5:15.
I think she, like, checked the laundry or something, and she was going to go downstairs to make coffee.
Yeah. And they didn't call until 5:50. But this is the other... 5:52. Yeah. But this is the other thing, too, Chris. They were going to go to their lake house, right, in Michigan. Where is it in Michigan again, Bobby?
Lake Charlevoix.
Lake Charlevoix.
Charlevoix.
You know, you're from there, Chris? Charlevoix?
You ever been?
Oh, Charlevoix.
Charlevoix!
Oh, geez.
Oh, wow.
Oh, apology to our viewers for the past 50 episodes.
They're not listening to this.
Yeah, they will.
Oh.
We're gonna tell them to listen to this.
Charlevoix. Wow, kind of suspicious that
you
do that.
I'm gonna say Charlevoix.
Well, the whole point being is that here they're going to go on a private...
Wait, did he go there? I want to know if he went there.
Did he go there, Chris?
I have been close by there. Yeah, because I think that's up by, like, Traverse City.
Oh, Traverse City, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but the point being is that they were going to go on their flight early in the morning. Like, what time were they going to have to be by the airport, Bobby?
Supposedly the flight was going to leave at 7.
So the flight was going to leave at 7.
So they were waking up at 5:30.
For them to wake up at 5:30 to go on a flight at 7 a.m.
And don't you think this is pre-9/11. Pre-9/11, so they weren't going to have to go through as many checks.
Well, that's
but
true.
But he was going to be co-piloting it. And you could say that his, you know, co-pilot, Mike Archuleta, interesting, no relation to Kim, was going to be piloting the plane for him. So, but it is weird that they, I don't think, part of my main theory is I believe they got up way earlier than they said.
Yeah.
I think they definitely found her well before they made the call, but yes.
And that's, and possibly, I mean, there's also evidence that, you know, that indicates maybe they didn't go to bed at all. you know?
For at least Patsy.
And that's the thing with this case. There's so many things where it's like, okay, this one gets us 70% this way. This one gets us 90% right. this way. And then it's like, and then you have to see how the pieces fit together, but also knowing that some of the variables can't coexist at the same time. So then that puts them in different columns of things.
Right.
But, and then you have to kind of almost go off of, you know, the preponderance of evidence of each thing. But that you'll then it could indicate what's most likely, but you're not going to get certainty. And then you also still have to get past all the smoke screens and things that are almost like landmines. Right. You know, landmines.
Right, that's why we're at 50 episodes. Too,
50 episodes.
I don't know if we originally anticipated that it would be, you know, this much, but it's like there's still so much to look into. Because, like, as he keeps saying right there, that she was the first murder in Colorado there.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing an upcoming episode on the fact that actually wasn't really true.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ramseys' former housekeeper,
mm-hmm.
Geraldine Vadika, mm-hmm. She's the one that gives the account of Burke supposedly smearing feces on the wall of his bedroom and then mm-hmm. being told by neighbor to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Her daughter was actually murdered in early December of the same year and month. It was December 7th, I believe, 1996.
Yeah.
She was found in a hole near her apartment in like a construction site where she was like half naked and bruised and beaten.
Don't give it all away, Bobby.
I'm not going to give it all away, but I'm just going to say it wasn't initially ruled a murder just for reasons of Boulder. And it's more about Boulder and their optics for themselves sometimes. So it's like, was JonBenet really the first murder that year? But yeah.
Weird how close that is to, you know, mm-hmm. just even the proximity of the Ramsey family.
You kept saying the first murder that year, so I thought you were baiting me.
Well, I mean, you can give it a little tease, but we'll work on it.
We got it.
You know, another interesting thing about this case is, I know you've mentioned it earlier and you've done episodes on it, is that ransom note. And I didn't really fully appreciate how many, I guess you could call it, oddities there are about that ransom note. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on some of the things that are kind of weird or interesting about it?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you mean that you didn't fully appreciate the oddities?
There was, like, I never realized that it was the longest ransom note in, like, kidnapping or FBI
history. In
history,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. That's perfect right there. And that's the thing is, it, and also the circumstances of how it wasn't, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was left there with a body. That's never happened. But the ransom note is super long, doesn't ever mention.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
In her name,
mm-hmm.
There was also, again, a practice note found that was starting to address it as Mr. and Mrs.
Right.
But the note that we know it as it now is
that way
Mr.
in the trash.
Ramsey.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was just mm-hmm. like, oh, we need to focus on him. Mm-hmm. And some people will argue that it seemed like it was objective based to get John out of the house. It's very filled. It's filled with movie references where we did a whole.
So many movie references.
We did a whole Seen It game with Teddy for him mm-hmm. to guess the references.
I remember learning that, Bobby. I was
fun. But there's references to Speed, Dirty Harry, Ruthless People.
Uh-huh.
It's very, it's not, it's as any seasoned investigator would describe it as basically like a ransom note you'd see in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a real ransom note.
Yeah. And then for it to be like splayed out on the stairs, even while JonBenet's body was like in the basement.
Right.
It's like, okay, so you guys just still left it there or whatever. And then not to mention that we haven't even begun to go into all the weird commonalities and details about the penmanship of the letter, along with other people, especially with Patsy Ramsey's handwriting,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, we to this day, we still find things that we're, you know, we're learning new insights in. But you can, if you parse, like, and you look through it, there's like certain letters where, you know, even the eyes, for example.
And she changed how she started writing.
Mm-hmm, she did.
After this whole ransom. Mm-hmm. And also, but before we get into too much of the handwriting, mm-hmm. the amount of the ransom was also very odd. Because it was only asking for $118,000.
Yeah.
And supposedly this is for some foreign terrorist faction.
Which also...
is, like, you know, doesn't respect its business or whatever. We respect your business, but not the country it serves. But it's also a weird amount. It's a very... People have tried to relate it to his, you know, bonus, which John has even kind of refuted in later interviews. Like, well, that's something I offered up. Like, almost as if he was sick of hearing that the bonus mm-hmm. theory.
But it's such a weird, specific number, $118,000, mm-hmm. especially for a family that, I mean, John's company had just crossed the $1 billion threshold as a subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. Mm-hmm. And so this family was very, very wealthy. Their house had over 120 windows. Okay. And so
it's true.
It was something like that, Bobby. Okay. But the point being is, I mean, how many windows you got, Chris? I don't got nine. I got no windows. Okay. I live inside of a Journeys in a mall.
Same. Yeah.
It's a decommission mall. But the point being is just that they had a lot of wealth. So what is even $118,000? And why is that specific number? But then also with this whole ransom letter, aside from just it being so similar to Patsy's handwriting, it was so strangely written. Like, it's not like a real ransom letter. It's something that Mel Gibson would be holding in a movie.
That was in theaters at the time.
Which was the movie Ransom was in theaters. Yeah. And so it's just, so it is weird. It is a very weird thing. And it's also one of those things where in this day and age, if you were to, when you look at the Ramses, when you see the Ramses on TV, whether it's John Ramsey or his elder son, John Andrew Ramsey, which a lot of people had no idea they even had an older son that also had a bedroom in that house and who may have been there Christmas Eve, Christmas Day time.
Well, he was cleared.
He wasn't cleared, Bobby. But
he was cleared officially.
He was official channels, the same channels that we call into question.
Again, and this is part of our podcast, I want to say right now. Yeah. There's discourse on it. We aren't all just like a hill, let's go after the Ramsey's thing. Our theories have evolved.
Mm-hmm. And we disagree.
He very much has this whole jaw thing.
I mean, I don't necessarily think, well, we don't even need to get into that. But the claim is that John Andrew Ramsey was in Atlanta at the time. But there are people who said that there might have been, because he was 21 or 20 years old at the time, that there were people, neighbors, who said that they saw someone of a frame of like a 20-something-year-old man who,
Barnhill.
Yeah, the Barnhill's another neighbor, too.
The guy with the bicycle. Yeah. One of the first articles, he's described that he was there Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes to it, I forgot my point, though, Bobby.
You were being hung up on Jar. That was it.
No, it was more than that.
I don't remember.
Well, I don't know, because you interrupted me.
I'm sorry.
This is also part of it, where sometimes I have to fight for the respect I deserve. Just to voice my opinion, just because he might be a little bit more comfortable, Bobby, with, I don't know, the patriarchal system. And just just believe in systems at their word. Sometimes I got to be the one to go, well, that's what they say.
The discourse. That's what we're about. Yeah. There we go.
We're okay with having conversation, because that's also a thing. People have lost the art of conversation. You know what I mean? And it's not about necessarily agreeing with who you're talking to or whatever. It's just about getting ideas out there, maybe learning from each other and maybe accepting each other, you know? And it's something that's really important for me, because I've just lived most of my life without people really ever accepting me for who I am. And it's just something that I still work with every day. And no therapist wants to take on me anymore, because they say that I don't bathe enough. I got too much poop in my cuticles.
Okay, that's enough. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Chris.
Chris poops.
All right, everybody poops.
You pooped today, Chris?
See? Yes, I did.
See?
We're getting closer to his deepest, darkest secret.
Yeah.
One other question I had on the ransom note is the fact that you had mentioned the practice note that was found. Because of that fact, we can confidently say that this ransom note was something, it was written, you know, on the spot. So this wasn't like a note that if a perpetrator did it, they didn't bring it with them, which it sounds like that's kind of like a key thing regarding the ransom note and this case.
Absolutely.
Right, because it was written on Patsy's notepad.
Mm-hmm.
It was a notepad that was found in the house, and it was written with her marker as well. Mm-hmm. And John turned that over to the police when they asked for handwriting samples. He's like, oh, here's Patsy's notepad, and then he wrote some stuff for them. And they didn't realize until they were back at the headquarters meeting with the FBI where they're like, oh, this hey, is... they got the note that it was like, hey, this ransom note was written on the same
pad. On the same pad.
So they're immediately like, hey, we need to start getting a search warrant for the house.
Mm-hmm.
And within, I would say, 20 minutes of this all happening at the Boulder police headquarters, John goes and finds the body.
In the basement.
And it makes it so the situation, which was now going to be handled by the FBI, has now been turned back over to the Boulder PD because it's a murder and it's now no longer kidnapping. Because it's like, oh, no, the FBI guy got swayed.
Mm-hmm.
It's very conspiratorial when it comes to that. You know, it could just be coincidental, but it is very suspicious that right after they were like, hey, we're going to get a search warrant for the house, start doing this things the right way with the FBI, that it's like, oh, no, we found the body. Don't worry.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's still a murder. I'm gonna go ahead and throw a blanket on it. We're gonna contaminate this even further.
Yeah,
just like it was like that was done in the OJ thing too, which they were very aware of. You know, all of the stuff surrounding that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
How different does the case become if John never finds the body right away, and this does turn into a kidnapping, and the you know the FBI gets involved? Is this like a completely different case if that happens?
That's a great question.
That's a great question.
That's a great question, Chris.
I think it would have been a completely different situation where the family would have been properly sequestered to be questioned, and we would have gotten to the truth a lot sooner.
Yeah, and for the FBI to have jurisdiction in that instance, you know, it's a very it's a different level of seriousness, especially in terms of the relationships or lack thereof that the Ramseys may or may not have with people who've got boots on the ground and are around them or are the first responders in this case. I mean, you know, we delve into it throughout different episodes, but there are connections. There are, you know, 6 degrees of separation between the Ramseys and people in the Boulder Police Department high up, or at least in the DA.
Because that's the thing, we want to keep it with the Boulder DA's office, who has a history of not taking things to trial, not convicting people, making, you know, back alley deals, and actually abusing the grand jury system to get the exact same outcome they ended up getting with the ransom.
Right.
So they knew that, like, hey, if this is federally, this would have been way different. So then
they don't have the same relationship.
Ron Walker asked Commander John Ella, like, hey, I can stick around and like you can use our resources if you want. And John Ella, the same guy who warned the cops arriving, like, hey, treat them like they're victims. John Ella told Ron Walker, the FBI agent, he goes, no, we don't need you.
We don't need you.
We don't need you. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
You think you got this?
Right.
Your supposed first. It's
very interesting. It's not.
But yeah, the FBI, it would have been.
It's not the logical way you would think someone would respond, especially for resources, especially if their heart was in it was intent in the same way that they described it was. There's things that feel like, oh, you know, they almost indicate that these guys wanted to cover something up, or certain people did. Nothing is a monolith, you know. But if the FBI still had their hands on it, they probably would have been very, the Ramseys would have been fucked over in the sense of the kind of control they were trying to have. Because, I mean, even after the body was discovered, and which then killed it from being a kidnapping case and put it back into Colorado, you know, like, you know, local jurisdictions, even then, like the next day they wanted to still get on the plane and fly, you know, they wanted to fly to Atlanta. There were all these different things that the FBI would not have allowed them to do.
Absolutely. Right.
And then would not have allowed them to, you know, even stay. They probably would have been sequestered and put in the different interrogation rooms, and more fucking things would have been figured out, you know. Probably one of them would have cracked if we were to go along with the theory of them being participants in the cover-up.
And it's interesting that they try to now portray, like, wanting, like, you know, they try to portray it like the Boulder Police didn't want the FBI involved and that they wish they would have been involved. And it's like the FBI actually still stuck around to assist. And then only officially bowed out when they saw this whole presentation and Alex Hunna was asked, like, hey, are you going to assemble a grand jury? And Alex Hunna, the DA at the time, said, I got to get back to you. It's a political issue. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
And for the FBI, the next day they told Steve Thomas, famous detective on the case, we can no longer be involved.
Yeah, they knew that this was radioactive. And that was what, a couple years later?
Yeah, that was in 98.
98.
It was like June of 98.
So for 2 years, they were trying to give their assistance to basically, you know, people who were basically saying, or trying to stonewall them in many ways, and then ultimately set it right to their face, like, well, this is a political matter for us, like whether we want to even go forward with this or not, you know. And ultimately, I mean, as you did you hear the details from our podcast about the grand jury, Chris?
That was another thing. Did you guys mention how the grand jury, the narrative up until just kind of recently was that the grand jury didn't indict them, but that turned out to be false. They actually did say, hey, you should, you know, indict these people on charges.
And yeah, they indicted the parent. Mm-hmm, and it was from like 98 until, no, it was 99 until 2013 is when it finally got revealed that like, oh, they chose to indict.
Yeah, the they voted to indict them.
Basically for assisting in, you know, first degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
And for covering up something. They didn't release all of the documents of it, but they released, you know, just part of the documents.
Yeah. But Alex Hunter, the same guy we were just talking about, the DA, he made the unilateral decision because it was his job.
Not to sign the true bills. Yep.
Yeah. To not go forward with those recommendations. And then he did a press conference where he basically made it sound like the Ramseys had been, which is what I'm looking for, Bobby.
Cleared.
And then that also that no one was going to get any information about this grand jury from anybody for basically in public.
He put a very tight seal
without a judge's order or some shit. And so, and then, but then you look at like a year or so after the Ramseys did a press tour for their book, The Death of Innocence. And you read inside The Death of Innocence and how they describe things and their whole media PR circus. Sometimes they try to do it without actually outright lying. And then sometimes they actually lie. But they always try to frame it to make it sound like they were acquitted and that they were innocent. That the grand jury chose
not to indict him. Lynn Wood straight up just lied. He's like, the grand jury's all the evidence, and they said they didn't want him to indict. Like,
and for 15 years, that's literally the only official narrative until it was revealed through some, you know, miracle practically around 2014 that actually, no, they voted to indict.
Right.
They found him guilty.
Earlier, I had asked about how much the case changes if the FBI gets involved, but how much does the case also change if the Boulder police, who is searching the house, and they, one of the officers or multiple, are in the basement where JonBenet is eventually found? I mean, how much does the case change if one of those police officers finds JonBenet versus her dad?
I think that's honestly, there's some theories that I look at now where I think they kind of wanted them to find her earlier on, possibly, where it seemed like the way everything was set up is that they didn't, somebody maybe instructed them to be like, hey, you can't be the ones to find it, because that does not end up good for parents when you're the one that found the dead body. So if you want to say that maybe they did construct this scene, and then that's why they invited the friends over, was the thing where they have these police show up, and then they get there, and then it's like looking around, and it's like, damn it, they didn't find it.
Mm-hmm.
Fleet goes down there, and it's like, shit, he didn't find it either.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no one's finding it, and it's like, we need it to be found, so it's like, we can classify this as a murder, because now the FBI is getting involved. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want the FBI involved.
Well, once they learn that the FBI once is, you know, on their way, basically, and, you know,
so when
when John is like, soon after goes down to the basement with Fleet and then finds her.
So when they speak on their incompetence, I don't think they're necessarily wrong in that, like, I think they did want to find a kind of thing, but also in the way of they knew they were taking advantage of the incompetence with this B squad that was, you know, the day after Christmas, and the first police officer gets there and some of the neighbors are already there. So it's a confusing thing of like, oh, am I supposed to clear these people out? Like, what am I doing? Like, you don't have a kidnapping, but you're trying to do your best kind of thing. And they were taking advantage of that. But I think that I think they did want the Boulder police to find her earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I definitely think they would have.
I don't think they wanted to be the one to find her.
It probably would have made, in some twisted way, their life a lot easier if someone else had found the body, except for one of them, because, you know, that throws all these other questions into play about John Ramsey being down in the basement and, you know, and then grabbing and seeing JonBenet and his scream within a dream where he's screaming out loud, or is he? And then he, you know, grabs her body and goes upstairs and all that thing. And it's just, you know, I really find it incredulous how at the time of the ransom, or the ransom letter said that there would be a call from the kidnappers around like 10 something in the morning, right? And also the ransom letter said something of like, get lots of rest, John, which this is a ransom letter that would be discovered in the morning of December 26th. And yet there were instructions in like how they wanted their money and to get the money. And then they say, and get some rest before we call you at 10 a.m. And it almost makes me go, how would you do all that stuff within a couple hours and get some rest? It almost makes me wonder if like the ransom, the kidnappers in the narrative concocted by the ransom letter were supposed to call on the 27th. Like it was almost designed for Patsy or someone to maybe have more time to either get John out of the house, blah, 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 keep him preoccupied, get rid of the body so the body wouldn't be there by to be discovered at all, and to follow through with the kidnapping storyline. But then, even then, when they are all waiting for a phone call in the 10 o'clock hour, and you got the Ramses and you've got some of their friends, you've got only, what was it, two police officers who stayed at the house prior to when the kidnappers were supposed to call. And yet when we watch most NCIS SVUs and things where we see like, oh, we've got a whole bunch of people huddled around a phone, you know, and translators and audio people, blah, blah, you know, there's usually a big production about, oh, we're waiting for the kidnappers to call. And yet in this case, they actually excused many of the police officers that first arrived around 6 a.m. in the 6 o'clock hour before the kidnappers even made their phone call, so that there were only two people there.
Yeah, it was around 9:45.
Yeah, was it even just two or just one? Was it just Linda Arndt?
It was just Linda Arndt.
So just one officer
left with like around nine people in the house.
Yeah, at the time, and then they never made the call, and it's like
no one brings it up.
No one brings it up. Yeah, no one's like, well, isn't it weird that they didn't call yet or whatever?
Which the Ramsey will say now, like, oh, I thought it was tomorrow, but it's interesting that that's not in any of Linda's reports. Like, oh, nobody went up to her and was like, yeah, maybe they'll call tomorrow.
Maybe tomorrow, the 27th. Yeah.
And
no,
it's a very weird situation.
And then it's still only 2 hours after that the body's discovered by the father, right after he may have been tipped off that the FBI are considering this a kidnapping and that's in their jurisdiction. And he knows that that's no bueno.
Right. I'm sorry. I feel like we're hijacking your thing and going all over the place with the narrative of the story.
No, he's interviewing us. He says he doesn't talk.
It seemed like he was going in order. I couldn't tell.
No, this is perfect. I love listening to you guys. You know, one other part of the household that confused some people, and I'll be honest, it kind of confused me on how it fits into everything, are the pineapples and cream. How does that exactly fit into what happened that day or that night?
Well, so there was a bowl of like pineapples and milk left out. Supposedly, pineapples and cream was a treat that Patsy liked to give the children. Mm-hmm. It's also mentioned in the play that she would do the scene from, the Prime of Miss Jean Brody.
Lots of references from that play.
She loves French stuff. But so that bowl was sitting out, and the coroner seemed to have found what looked like pineapple in her esophagus, mm-hmm. which allowed them to determine basically that she was killed within a certain amount of time mm-hmm. of eating this because she hadn't fully digested this mm-hmm. at all. And the Ramses again maintained that everybody was kind of in bed and they didn't feed her any pineapple. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know what that's about, but she didn't eat any. And this bowl that was left out, we know, has Patsy's prints on it and Burke's prints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for her to have eaten it, it would have been around midnight, based off of like where it was and where it was in the Magic School Bus journey of digestion toe, where it was they like were
11
like
to 1
they were like we were like, they were able to pinpoint, yeah, like between 11 and 1, which, you know, the mean is midnight, and then it would have been like X amount of time before she was killed. So it's like anybody who would have prepared her this, and there was also a big portion of pineapple in there. Like, it wasn't like it was just like, oh, like a couple chunks. It was like a full bowl. Mommy, it was a full bowl.
Well, the bowl, yeah, but not
what she ate, but I'm saying, yeah, like, what was out there. Yeah. Like, so it's like,
It was very prepared, very childlike.
See, yeah.
Patsy said she would never prepare a bowl like that.
Yeah, and but anybody who prepared that would have been, one, up at the same time as JonBenet, if JonBenet took a bite from it, and then two, would have been up in close proximity to the time when JonBenet died because of where that was located in her esophagus. And so for them, for a long time, they even tried to just go like, minimize the fact that there was this pineapple, but then also try to, you know, separate themselves from any association with it. Like, I did not give JonBenet pineapple, you know, because they had the narrative that she was fast asleep the last time they saw her, mm-hmm. which, depending on what story that you hear, was either closer maybe to like 10:45 or was closer to like 9:45, mm-hmm. you know, because they revised it when they arrived home.
And on the pineapple, too, the CBS documentary that the Ramses ended up suing, or Burke Ramsey ended up suing, that they basically determined with like a panel of experts, and including the guy that wrote the book, Foreign Faction, James Cola, they determined basically that Burke Ramsey did it because, and they added the motive that they think that like he got angry that she took a piece of his pineapple and chased and hit her. I thought that was kind of a misstep on that part. And it's like kind of how Steve Thomas subscribed it to bedwetting, trying to find like the motive there where it's saying specifically, oh, he got mad over pineapple, where it's like, I feel like that's where you're going to trip yourself up if you get too hung up on like, this is specifically what happened.
Right. But that doesn't necessarily eliminate the fact that he could have had pineapple that that he prepared, pineapples and cream, and that she could have had a bite of it. Mm-hmm. It's just that he could have gotten mad at her for something else, or something else could have happened.
Right.
But maybe they were both asleep or both awake at the same time.
Right.
And also, you know, the Prime of Miss Jean Brody, you know, having pineapples and cream in that is just also another weird detail of the parallels between this play that Patsy Ramsey has, you know, kind of hitched to a sticking post of like, this is part of what she sees herself as a sophisticated person. Because it was a movie starring Professor McGonagall from Harry Potter's in the 60s. That actress, Maggie Smith, she actually won Best Actress for it. It was a play that Patsy Ramsey did when she, you know, was for a talent portion of Miss West Virginia. And then also when she was running for Miss USA. And then and the fact that that letter has so many parallels, like the pineapples and cream, and also the letter, or a letter that's kind of like the main plot point. And also that some of the details about like the qualities of the letters are similar too. And the fact that, you know, with Patsy's handwriting, which we've researched as well, I mean, her handwriting could never be effectively 100% ruled out with that letter, that ransom letter. And so it's just it's almost like a neatly tucked narrative.
It points to Patsy. There's an overwhelming majority of people that, like, unanimously agree that Patsy wrote the note. Mm-hmm. Next steps is figuring out who actually killed her, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that maybe one of the reasons then why their behavior then after the murder was so kind of weird and uncooperative? Because I know you guys have talked about how they hired a PR firm and they did interviews with the news before they ever really talked to police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot in their immediate response that, you know, we can't magic school bus go right into their brain and Miss Frizzle figure out why they're doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. They were grieving. But so, like, you have to give them that credit where it's like you don't know exactly what you do.
That's
but
true.
A lot of the behavior then once even
doesn't seem cooperative and doesn't seem it seems counterintuitive and also just seems downright antagonistic or in the sense of actually helping the investigation when it matters most. It's the immediate time after.
Once they got Patsy off drugs, it seemed like it was like, oh, you can go on the news now a lot better. Where it's like, yeah,
because that's how they got basically around talking or having the police get too much access to them. Was that Patsy was like heavily medicated, they were staying at their friend's house, and they had, you know, a priest and a bunch of people like all around them. And basically going like, she can't talk, blah, 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 blah. And then they went ahead.
There for that.
Well, yeah. But then they went ahead and did that interview with CNN on January 1st. And then after that, like, I mean, we have to kind of go into, I mean, we just finished the month of January of this year. Imagine there's the entire month of January. Then there's an entire month of February. And then there's an entire month of March.
Well, they got out. They got to Atlanta.
They got out. For those 3 months, they were the main suspects in the public's eye. And they, you know, and things were starting to like turn on them. And it wasn't until they like actually then interviewed with the police towards the end of April. And then around that same time that Lou Schmidt, who is an investigator, came out with the intruder theory, that they finally had something else to, you know, to direct any sort of and fixate like any potential blame or culprit of like it being an intruder, which is then how the two major subreddits now, well, the intruder theory. The intruder did it, or the Ramses did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are like the two main
divide,
cleaves. And
but their argument too, again, normally for like what your question was in the aftermath of this stuff, how they behaved is normally just immediately going to, you don't know how you'd behave, like in this thing. Mm-hmm. Which again, I'll give them the credit for the first week kind of thing. But then going to the news, still weird. But then again, continuing the behavior of being uncooperative, just, you know, getting out of, you know, Boulder kind of thing, so we don't have to talk to the police.
I mean, why would you leave the state when your daughter, you know, died in your house?
You got to get out of there. If they let you go, it's but now that, they have to subpoena you to get you
that's
back.
That's a consciousness of guilt. That's a guilty conscience. That's not something that an innocent person would do.
No, I agree.
And that's the thing. It's like their response and how they engaged or how they didn't engage with the Boulder Police Department. Even if one were to go, like, okay, if I were in their shoes, like, you know, until that happens to me, I can't judge. It's like they milk that. They rely on that, right? Because they also all because they're used to having I mean, it's a class system story too. The way that they're handled with kids' gloves is very different than how 99.99%, including you, any of us, would be handled in this same circumstance. Mm-hmm. And it's because they have money. And because they knew those people, it's because they probably donated to the political causes of the people who eventually become the a district attorney. You know what I mean? And it's like, and then when like push comes to shove, some kind of crisis comes like this. This is when you, like, you know, everybody kind of closes in and sort of works together. And they didn't, you know, there's an incentive for things, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours, or like, you know, now you got to pay the troll toll, you know, for these people to not basically do what they were hired to do or what we, you know, would expect a parent to react. Like, they just didn't do it. Right. And then they try to justify it by saying, but this is how we react because, like, we've been in this situation. It's like, you made it.
You had mentioned that detective, Lou Smith, was it?
Lou Smith.
For his theory on an intruder, you know, entering the home and murdering JonBenet Ramsey, by what method or how would this have intruder entered the home, or how would it have even gone down in his opinion?
Lou's opinion was basically through the basement window. He heard through the office chatter at Boulder PD, someone mentioned you couldn't even fit through the window. And then, like, that clinch point for him was just like, oh, my God, you couldn't fit. He's like, I can fit through the window. Here, I'm going to show you a video of me fitting through the window. I think they came in through the window. And I think, honestly, for the intruder people, it's a misstep to even think that, like, oh, maybe that's actually the point of entry, when I think it could have been any point in the house. As in, I don't necessarily think all of the house was completely secured that night anyways. But, yes, Lou Smith's theory was that somebody came in through the basement. There's a scuff mark on the wall, and that they possibly used a suitcase to prop themselves to get out. Mm-hmm. The window had previously been broken by John, supposedly, over the summer, and he just never got it fixed. So they think they came in through there and exited through there. But the Boulder police found that there were cobwebs that were undisturbed and that it didn't seem like anybody actually came through that grate.
Well, and to add to that, like, John Ramsey said that he had broken through that window earlier that August in order to get into the house when he locked himself out. And Burke Ramsey, in supporting his father when he was a little kid, was like, oh, yeah, I remember that, Dad. But this was a time in which Burke was actually away at a summer camp. So then so that's point A.
And then John turned it into, like, oh, there was another time.
Uh-huh. And then point B is that there was glass from that broken window on top of that suitcase. But that suitcase had materials and DNA things that were tied to events that happened that night. So there was stuff that was put in that suitcase that then was things like, what were they, Bobby? It was like her clothes or
The suitcase, what was it, had like a duvet in it, and it had a little blanket thing in like the Dr. Seuss book. But that's also just according to these court documents for the Wolf versus Ramsey case, that people don't say you should rely on this thing that her DNA was actually in there.
Oh,
so it's really up for debate on whether or not was used to rub her down. But it's very interesting that the Ramseys will publicly still tout that, like, oh, yeah, her DNA was put in that suitcase. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody tried to put her in there, which, bullshit, that rigor mortis was way too set in.
Yeah.
And then it's also a thing of, like, well, let's talk about what else was in the suitcase, which was, you know, John Andrews, you know, duvet that had semen on it. You know, he's a young kid. It's completely fine. You're going to do that.
People jerk off.
But you guys can't be talking about one part of the contents of the suitcase if we're not going to be like, talking about the other,
the other part.
Especially if it's up for debate whether or not the DNA was actually in there.
And especially if that stuff that, you know, the DNA, you know, supposedly, like, that's on the items in there, like, it's tied to DNA, like, you know, that's pivotal to, like, the night of the crime. So it's like, you know, stuff like, basically they're saying that suitcase was opened up and this stuff was put in there or something that same night. But then that suitcase is put upright and then has glass from the broken window on top of it, which, but then John Ramsey's trying to tell me that that broken window was broken almost 6 months earlier or 4 months earlier. You know what I mean? And so it's just like where it's very, it doesn't all come together. And this isn't to mention Eva, that we noticed that when Brooke Ramsey was interviewed by Dr. Phil, he made some kind of offhand comment about how there was a, that he, what was it, Bobby? That he may have left the front door unlocked.
Exactly,
but that wouldn't have stopped anybody anyway if it was locked. And so it's like, why are we even talking about this window and this Lou Smith thing? Because Lou Smith's thing was that he could figure out like clues and stuff when he was like on at the crime scene.
For the first day.
With, on the, when right when it happened.
Yeah.
A ground zero, but not 9/11 ground zero.
No, but unrelated.
Then, but yeah, but then this is a case where he was there 4 months, 5 months later. And so it's irrelevant. And so,
sorry, I gave him gas X before because he's normally pretty.
Yeah,
gassy.
I'm really gassy,
but he's been doing a lot better.
I've been well, you know. Yeah,
I get way more burps.
I have to sleep with one eye open, and I've got a little shiv made out of like a little TCBY spoon.
Or else, what the gas monster is going to get you? What are you?
No,
about?
I mean when you live in an when you live in a closed down mall with other people who, you know, they're desperate sometimes.
Yeah, okay.
So it's just, you know, you got to be careful.
What were we saying? Sorry.
Well, we were just talking about just that there's holes even in that intruder theory. But, you know, this is the thing. When it came to, like, NBC or ABC or CBS or CNN, for years, who would they interview? There weren't people like us to interview. Or they would always interview people that they were like, oh, this guy has a storied reputation as solving all these murders and crimes and stuff. And so we would just hear the Lou Smith theory propagated, but it was conveniently propagated right around the time that the Ramseys finally agreed to be interviewed with by the Boulder police, which they also got like the case files on at one point, and then to almost prepare for their interrogations. And then at the same time, like, you know, Lou Smith then joins the DA and he's working for them, and he's, you know, and then he resigns at a certain point when it's like, you know,
when Steve Thomas
resigns, so it looks like it's tit for tat.
It wasn't
until
2001 after the book had came out and they'd supposedly been cleared by the grand jury that then Lou Smith started going public with, hey, I've got a few suspects.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time he went public with people. He was like, hey, here's a few people. And the people that he describes are like,
yeah,
Michael Helgoff and
yeah,
other people. And like
a bunch of people that we also elaborate more about in our show, where we spend episodes dedicated to them, because it's like sometimes just to explore, you know, it's like watching a flower bloom, you know, or when you have like a hemorrhoid and you got to push your butt lips out.
Nope.
Where it's just like you just get to see a little bit more of it all exposed. And sometimes that helps us to rule someone out or to maybe go, oh, I didn't have this question before.
Right.
And I mean, and that's how complex this case is. I mean, even we've talked for about an hour already. And I mean, we've spent the last year doing hour long installments, and there's still so much more to even talk about. One time.
Going along this topic of like the behavior of the family after the body was found, eventually when they do get interviewed, are there oddities with the interviews that they did with police, and maybe particularly when Burke was interviewed with police? Because mm-hmm. he was, if I remember correctly, it was just him with the police. Like, he wasn't there with his parents by his side.
You were talking about on December 26th? Yeah, he was sent away from the house very early morning, where it was like they were going to have him go stay over at Fleet White's house.
Mm-hmm. And this is the morning of.
He was in the care of Priscilla, which is Fleet White's wife, his mm-hmm. sister. She was in the care of Burke. And while there, one of the Boulder police detectives basically tried to get an interview with him. And so Priscilla's sister pretended to be Burke's grandmother
mm-hmm.
and gave them permission to interview Burke. So that first interview with Burke that we have that you could look up, I don't think it came out until much later, possibly after 2000. Because the Ramseys really weren't even aware of it until around the grand jury time
mm-hmm.
that there was an interview that took place with Burke. But that's where Burke gives the account of JonBenet. He saw her walking up the stairs.
Which later, before. The official Ramsey story was that she was carried up the stairs after falling asleep in the car
mm-hmm.
on the Christmas night. So that's like an incongruency.
Mm-hmm. But the Ramseys, I mean, they've made plenty of different statements. Like they've changed the tune over certain things over time, where like if you look at the 98 interviews versus the 97 ones, 98, they're like throwing so many people at the wall of like, oh, it could be this person or this person. And it's almost, it's even John's business partner where it's like almost they're like, is this arranged to be like, oh
yeah,
I look, I'm allowed to look suspicious enough. It's a, it's very differing in tones, but you can find the full transcripts online. But people should be warned too that the transcripts that is available to the public is transcribed from a like a Ramsey sympathizer. She was the first online supporter of the Ramseys. They even mentioned her in their book. Her name's Jameson on the thing. We did a whole episode on her too. But she ended up selling, she got these, this package arrived at a door that was basically all the videotapes of their interviews. And so she transcribed them and sold them to tabloids for like $40,000. But so the interviews that we have are really just all transcribed from her. And it's interesting because like one of them, she puts like Pete Hofstrom's there. Never does he speak up. But in the actual, like Steve Thomas's book, he describes different accounts in the interrogation of like, oh, I almost had Patsy where I wanted her. And then her lawyers interjected and we asked to take a break. This, if you go through the interviews, is not actually found in the transcript. So you got to be careful with the information that we have out there, but it is a good source of, you know.
And there's videos of when Burke was doing his, some of his conversations, like he would have like a psych, like a child psychologist or whatever the fuck, like asking him some questions and things too. And, but there were some interviews where he, like, especially when we, this ties back to the pineapple, where like when they were talking about like, what kind of snacks would you have after school? Or, you know, they were just trying to basically get him to say pineapple. To a degree that was, it's almost
comical.
It's comically apparent. He does not, it's almost like he was instructed. He's not to ever say pineapple, or he's like, I think pineapple.
Yeah, they
or
show him the picture of the of pineapple that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And like, what is that in there? He's like,
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, you literally, you know, your mother makes this for you and has for years. This is not a common thing that people eat. It's not like, I'm having ants on a log. No, it's pineapples and milk.
Right.
Okay. And it's something that she fucking probably like discovered because she, well, you know, read this play where they talked about having pineapples and cream.
Oh, that's an interesting.
And she's like, yeah, I'm not going to be no podunk outhouse piece of shit, white trash, pony boy bitch.
I put pineapples and milk.
I'm going to have pineapples and milk.
But it's called pineapples and cream.
Yeah.
Right, really supposed to use cream. But
you're supposed to use cream, but they don't got cream. I don't know what cream is. Stop asking about cream, Chris. But the point being is just that there were weird abnormalities regarding, especially with Birch.
What's the state of the Ramsey family today? I understand that, you know, Patsy has passed away, but John is, you know, John is still around. Burke is still around. What are they up to? Do we know?
Well, yeah, John's about like, I believe he's like 82 ish now.
He's got his, he's on his third wife.
He's out in Utah. He's the CEO of this, basically this flight touring company called Red Tail Adventures. He's remarried. Burke seems to be just like squirreled off away in Michigan where they don't seem to like talk that much. It seems like the relationship's strained. John Andrew, his son, which is John Bonet's half brother, he's going to be, they've already announced that he's going to be taking on the mantle of this case after, but he wasn't even there. So he's a, basically a glorified character witness.
Yeah. Or he might not have been there, or he might have been there.
Right. Right.
But either way, the official story is that he wasn't there.
But that's, yeah, so there he, Burke's off in Michigan, John's out in Moab, and they just recently met with the Boulder Police Department with a DNA company representative, Otham, I believe, and they supposedly had a meeting trying to encourage them to, you know, turn over the evidence, and John came out of the meeting saying he's very optimistic, but we'll see how long it takes before he turns that around again, because he just, it's a rinse and repeat cycle. If anybody that pays attention to the case over the years, it's always a thing, and then there'll be a suspect that already got cleared that'll come out later this year, like, oh, this guy could be it. And it's like, no, this guy was already cleared.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they're with their media offense. I mean, they have that Netflix documentary where on one hand, with the evidence, they're trying to say, oh, like, everybody's on the table. Like, we got to break open the case and look at every suspect that we've ever looked at. And then 5 minutes later, they, like, spend 5 minutes going, but not Burke. Not Burke. Burke is innocent. Burke is fine. And it really just seems like they're trying to do – it seems like if this were a case where it was a mother and a father going through a horrible worst-case scenario on a, on Christmas night of all nights, the night Jesus was born, where one kid is dead and the other kid might be involved – and they don't want to lose the living kid, that this is something where, like, you know, John Ramsey, like, he, you know, has spent years on this. You know, he's in his 80s. We'll see how long he has to live. John Andrew Ramsey, most people didn't even know anything about his, like, his existence for years. But now it's like they're trying to keep, they're trying to position him as the new spokesperson as John Ramsey 2.0.
And even painting out Burke. There was a 60 Minutes Australia last January that they there was never no mention of Burke. And they just made it seem like John Andrew is the brother.
They said John BenÉ and her brother, you know, at some point, her brother John still, Andrew. Yeah, look, but it's like they phasing out Burke, and then also they're trying to get the public to clear him.
Oh, and John Andrew supposedly has left his job, and this is now his full-time job. Supposedly. Wow. According to him, on Reddit.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, what we're going to see is that the further we get removed from the actual events, you know, the harder it's going to be to conclusively receive or, like, any sort of, you know, just short of any sort of, like, deathbed confession or something.
Well, yeah, or if this, you know, if they do some sort of analysis, like DNA thing, that actually does turn up something, you know?
Well, then that would be really nice. Mm-hmm. But we're basically going to see John Andrew Ramsey trying his best to be the authoritative voice that, you know, tries to put down any conspiracy theories and gets people to kind of accept his milquetoast sort of, you know, wasp male sort of authoritarian sort of position on things. But also it seems like they're trying to also make it so that we can get off of Burke's case so that he can live the rest of his very long life without being under this a certain scrutiny, you know? But even then, it's like, I don't know. Like,
Until it's solved, you know, we'll see.
And we're going to solve it.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. That's our plans for this year. So.
Yeah, yeah. And you can help us. You're helping us right now by doing this interview. I've had a really good time.
No, yeah, this has been a really great interview. You guys are great to talk to.
Thank you. Wait, can I ask you a question before we go, though?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's your deepest, darkest secret?
Gosh, I don't know.
It's something to do with foot stuff.
Probably. Foot stuff.
Wait, and you didn't. Well, so we should probably ask you though. You didn't. You know? Did you do it?
Yeah, you didn't do it, did you?
No. I would have been 5 in 1996.
Oh, interesting.
So now we're saying 5-year-olds can't kill 6-year-olds?
Yeah, well, okay. Someone,
you were in Michigan.
Yes, and I was in Michigan. Yeah.
You should go take a trip out to North Fox Island and let us know what it's like.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and Lake Charlevoix, too.
Take some photos.
Yeah.
You know.
Go stand outside Burke's house and give us the weather report.
Take a little shovel to that island, see if you find any tiny boy bones.
I'll plan on that for my upcoming vacation.
Okay. Well, we've had a great
charter
time, Chris.
A private plane, because that's the only way you can get there.
Yeah.
Or swimming.
Swimming, yeah.
Nature.
You know what I said?
Yeah.
Swimming.
Well, you guys have been awesome.
Thank you
very much. And the podcast is great. I hope people can go check it out.
JonBenÉ Today, TODET.
Yeah.
For people who also want to maybe connect with you, are you guys on social media at all?
Oh, yeah. You can find us at patreon.com/JonBenÉToday or X at JonBenÉToday or Facebook at JonBenÉToday.
We're social.
Instagram at JonBenÉToday.
I'm not going to obsess over you and look at everything in your profile and get all heavy, dovey breathing.
Don't accept any messages from Teddy.
I know boundaries. So. Yeah, we're socials.
Yeah, and YouTube.
And YouTube.
But anywhere you get your podcasts, JonBenÉ Today.
Mm-hmm. XTube.
Nope, not on XTube yet. Oh.
Well, I will. I'll include links to these in the description of the episode.
Okay.
And for everybody else out there, thank you very much for listening. My name
is Chris. Thank you, guys.
Yep. This has been Cheat Tash. Take care, everybody.